from deep inside your radio.
From Toronto, Canada. Think of it. Think of the irony, ladies and gentlemen. No, you know the irony. This is this week's thing. And before anything else, apropos of being in Toronto, Canada, which, by the way, is how you pronounce it. You know, you find out as you go around the world that we're pronouncing everything wrong. You go to Milwaukee, and it's Milwaukee. It's not Milwaukee. And similarly, here, it's Toronto. It's not Toronto. But more important, ladies and gentlemen, than sheer niggling over pronunciation, did you know, I was just reminded of this by walking around downtown Toronto yesterday and finding myself surrounded by identical black skyscrapers, which is always a nice look. Anyway, and realizing that all of them are owned by the same company. Now, switch to television commercials in the United States for a company called TD Ameritrade. Now, what could be more American than a company called Ameritrade? The TD stands for the name of the company that builds all those identical black skyscrapers in downtown Toronto, Toronto Dominion. Dominion meaning Dominion of Canada. So, yes, Ameritrade is Canadian. And imagine Pat Buchanan's outrage if Ameritrade were Mexican. See? But the Canadians only come over to take the good-paying jobs. So that's the difference. We have some fine... This was a good week for quotes, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, you know about Survivor, the new... You know about the show, first of all. You know it exists. All right, baseline of information there. And secondly, you know that this new edition of Survivor, after the ratings have plunged recently, recent series of Survivor, this new one pits teams based on their ethnicities. So now we have host of Survivor, Jeff Probst. The other day, he told television reporters he went to his dentist, who is white, and the dentist brought in another dentist, who is Asian. Quote, and I found myself saying to the Asian doctor, where in Asia is your family from? Unquote. The dentist said he was Korean, quoting Jeff again. The only reason I had the courage to even ask that question, or the knowledge to ask that question, was I just spent 39 days with people from Korea. Unquote. Asians, he explained, include Chinese and Japanese and Koreans, and, quote, they don't necessarily get along. He added, quote, this is stuff maybe I should know. No! Why? Being on network television means you should know the difference between Japanese, Chinese, and Koreans, Jeff? Don't worry, babe. Just smile. Now, we have, talking about things you should know, this from President George W. Bush's exclusive interview, one of many exclusive interviews he did and is doing, this one with Katie Couric.
One of the hardest parts of my job is to connect Iraq to the war on terror.
I'm not surprised. That is hard work. And finally, in the notable quotes of the week, this is Mark Elder, guest conductor of the Proms, which is like the Hollywood Bowl in London, except it's indoors. But it's the summer concert series. Mark Elder to the assembled crowd in Royal Albert Hall Saturday night, speaking about the new regulations in British airports that prohibit musicians from carrying their instruments as carry-on because they have to be checked in baggage.
The time has come really to put an end to this unfairness. Otherwise, it seems to me that next year we should all look forward to Concerto for Laptop and Orchestra.
Because the only thing they can bring aboard is a laptop. Although, I'll tell you, you can't even bring that on board if you're trying to bring it on board in your laptop holder, your laptop bag, as I found out when I flew back from Heathrow last week to the United States. Which would, ladies and gentlemen, be the most natural introduction to a copyrighted feature we call Tales of Airport Security. This one wasn't sent in by anybody. This was experienced by me. We're going to not even talk about the people who lied and said, no, your baggage can be checked straight through on the flight from Edinburgh to London and then from London to L.A. when it wasn't. No, we're not even going to talk about that. Or the guys in New Orleans who confiscated a gift from my wife that was packed in ice because it was ice. And I said, but the prohibited prescribed substances for carry-on are liquids, aerosols, and gels, and this is ice. Maybe it'd be a good idea to print up all the list of all the substances that, under the right circumstances, can turn to liquid. Ice, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm not even going to talk about the ground crew at Toronto Airport, Pearson International, who apparently don't go out and put out the jetway for arriving planes when they're arriving in a recently departed thunderstorm. I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about tales of airport security, ladies and gentlemen, at Heathrow Airport. If you look at the x-ray machine that your carry-on stuff has to go through in an American airport, you'll notice that there's a little metallic, at least at LAX there is. By the way, congratulations to LAX for finally allowing advertising. So we're no longer unique. There's a metallic shield around the output of the x-ray machine, and at LAX it has rounded corners. At Heathrow, it's transparent plastic, and it goes far beyond the end of the x-ray machine, and it has hard, pointed corners. Now, I'm going through security again at Heathrow, like I was promised I wouldn't have to do, but we're not talking about that. And the woman takes my little laminated, pathetic shopping bag that I was given by an airline employee when my computer bag was found to be too big for carry-on. And she wants to look at it. And she says, would you retrieve the rest of your belongings, please? So I lean down to retrieve my coat and my computer, which is in its own separate tray. And bang! My head hits something sharp. So hard that the woman behind me gasps, and I feel her arm reach up to prevent me from falling. Yes, I had leaned over, and it's transparent plastic with no markings, and hit my head on one of those hard pointed corners of the x-ray machine sneeze guard. So I said in the weird lucidity that often accompanies shock, I said to the woman who was inspecting my bag, you know, you guys should put like some kind of demarcation or like colored tape on that so people can see it. She just keeps going through my bag. And so I say, well, maybe I should talk to a supervisor. Moments later, or so it seemed, a woman shows up behind me and says, do you need an ambulance? And I think, now my wife is still downstairs trying to get the tax refund, so I'm separated from my wife. She's not telling me where the ambulance is going to take me. If I do take an ambulance, I'm going to have to go back through security for the third time today. Who knows what will happen? And I've been hit in the head. So I say, no, but you really should put some tape or some color demarc. And she says, do you need an ambulance? And I say, no. And she turns and walks away. And I realize that she's not been offering me an ambulance because she's concerned about how I feel. She's offering me an ambulance, so if I refuse it, she can say, well, he refused medical assistance. So now I'm hurt in the head, and I'm ticked. So I walk over to her supervisor. Oh, by the way, before I do that, the woman inspecting my bag gives me a shrug and says, what can you do? So I figure what I can do is report the supervisor to her supervisor. So I walk over and talk to the guy, and he says, well, I know who you mean, but I can't give you her name. But use my name when you report it. So now I'm feeling this impact my head had with a sharp object swelling. Nobody's offered me any ice. So I figured the only place I'm going to get some is in the lounge. And I'm walking to the lounge. And at Heathrow, to get from security to wherever you're going next, you just have to walk through a mile of stores. Perfume stores, luggage stores, mini department stores, food shops, bookstores. Stores selling stuff you can't even take on the plane. And I finally get to the lounge, and I say to the guy there, I'm going to need some ice. I had a head injury. And he goes and gets me some ice. And I'm sitting there with my ice on my forehead, right above the eye, right above the right eye. Fortunately, I don't make my career, you know, being on camera anywhere. So I'm not worried about the ugly scarring. And my wife shows up, finally, and she goes and talks to a representative from the airline who says, well, you know, there is a doctor, but we're in Terminal 3 and the doctor's in Terminal 2. Doesn't offer to transport me to Terminal 2 or to tell me how I'm going to get back and get on my flight. She says, we used to have a paramedic that bicycled around the terminals, but I haven't seen him lately. And my wife says, well, I think I'm going to go across the outside the lounge, across the hall to the drugstore to get something for his injury. And the woman brightens and she says, oh, that's a good idea. Ask the pharmacist in there what he should do. That is to say, ask the non-existent pharmacist in an airport drugstore to diagnose a head injury, ladies and gentlemen. Are you angry yet? I'm angry, just telling it. Three hours pass. Yes, a three-hour layover. And I get on the plane and I say to the flight attendant, I'm going to need some ice. And because I had this injury. And she asked me this question. Are you happy to fly today? It sounds like a bad translation from the Japanese, but that's what she says. And I said, well, happy. I wouldn't exactly say happy, given the circumstances. She disappears and reappears with the woman from downstairs who had said talking to the pharmacist was the best thing to do. And she says to my wife, well, you should have come back and talked to me again if you didn't want to go to the pharmacist. Like it was my wife's fault. And then this woman again says the magic phrase, are you happy to fly today? And I realize this is another legally prescribed question. And I say, you want me to say I'm happy to fly today? I walked into a plane voluntarily knowing that it was at some point, with all good luck, going to be airborne. So, yes, I'm happy to fly today. Tales of airport security, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of Hello, Welcome to the Show.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun up in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn.
and I'm feeling
from the Great White North, from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show and to a copyrighted feature called News from Outside the Bubble. Dateline Paris. France issued an implicit criticism of U.S. foreign policy, rejecting talk of a war on terror. Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin, speaking in Parliament, noted President Chirac's strong opposition to the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and said the Arab state had now sunk into violence and was feeding new regional crises. Quote, "Let us not forget that these crises play into the hands of all extremists," the Prime Minister said. Against terrorism, what's needed is not a war. It is, as France has done for many years, a determined fight based on vigilance at all times and effective cooperation with our partners. But he concluded, "We will only end this curse if we also fight against injustice, violence, and these crises." Truth, justice, and the French way, ladies and gentlemen. Be careful what you wish for. Dateline Baghdad, the notorious Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad, which we turned over to the Iraqis, as reported on this broadcast, is at the center of fresh abuse allegations, with claims that inmates are being tortured by their new captors. Staff at the jail say the Iraqi authorities have moved dozens of terrorist suspects into Abu Ghraib, where from a controversial Interior Ministry detention center where U.S. troops last year discovered 170 prisoners tortured and starved. A witness this week who went into Abu Ghraib said screams were coming from the cell blocks housing the terrorist suspects. Prisoners released from the jail this week spoke of routine torture. And on Wednesday, 27 prisoners were hanged in the first mass execution since Saddam left. Conditions in the rest of the jail were grim, according to the British newspaper The Independent, with an overwhelming stench of excrement. Prisoners crammed into cells for all but 20 minutes a day. Food rations cut to just rice and water, and no air conditioning. Some of the small number of prisoners who remained in the jail after the Americans left said they had pleaded to go with their departing captors rather than be left in the hands of Iraqi guards. Quote, "The Americans were better than the Iraqis. They treated us better," unquote, said one suspect, suspected of involvement in Sunni terrorism. The screaming that the witness heard continued for a long time. "I am sure someone was being bitten. They were screaming like they were being hit," the witness reported. "I felt scared. I was asking what was happening in the terrorist sections. I heard shouting like someone had a hot iron on their body." The officer said they were just screaming by themselves. And Dateline Kabul, Afghanistan, the Pakistani military, as we know now, this story appeared in McClatchy newspapers before it was announced this week. The Pakistani military is striking truces with Islamic separatists along the country's border with Afghanistan. And according to this report, freeing Pakistani militants and Al-Qaeda fighters to join Taliban insurgents battling against U.S.-led troops in Afghanistan. Western and Afghan officials say the new infiltration came as the United States, its NATO allies, and the Afghan government are struggling to stem a resurgence of the Taliban. The Pakistani regime of General Perv Musharraf has been negotiating truces with the Bush administration's encouragement with Islamic separatists in North and South Waziristan. In return, Pakistani officials are promising to restrict the country's troops in the area, that is, Pakistan's troops, to major bases and towns and to pour huge amounts of aid, much of it from the United States. I thought we couldn't afford to give money to New Orleans. Into the destitute region, according to American officials. As the truces take hold, according to this report from McClatchy newspaper, separatists have been crossing into Afghanistan to fight alongside Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters. Diplomats who discussed the issue requested anonymity because the problem is the subject of highly sensitive discussions among Pakistan, Afghanistan, the United States, and the commissioner of football. No, sorry. The separatists and the Taliban are Pashtuns, the ethnic group that dominates the tribal region. It's unclear whether the flow is an unintended consequence of the truces or is being ignored or encouraged by Musharraf's regime as part of the price for peace with the separatists. The Waziristan border is like somebody swung the gate open, says one Western diplomat. The Pakistanis have bought peace there by exporting the problem. Hey, you know, you got to export some. What's pretty clear is that a subtext of the truces is that the Islamic rebels in Waziristan have a free hand across the border, says a second Western diplomat. It points to a real probability of even higher level of violence in Afghanistan. Our friends, the Pakistanis. A senior national security aide to Afghani President Karzai criticized the Bush administration for accepting Pakistani assurances that the truces include rebel promises not to join the Taliban insurgency. He says, quote, "The thrust of Pakistan's strategy remains the same, how to milk the Americans for more money," unquote. Would you please teach that to Mayor Nagin? I think he needs to know that. But wait, there's more. That's news from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. But there's more news from Iraq that has appeared in this country. You might not have seen it. This probably you saw. A new study suggests the federal government has fallen back to prosecuting international terrorists about the same rate it did before 9/11. Hey, everything changed after 9/11. Do you remember right after 9/11 when they first introduced the crawls, the ticker under the screen of news channels? It continued through the commercials because the news was important back then. Everything's changed. The week that the NFL came back after 9/11, they dispensed with the sound effects out of respect. So now I guess they don't have any respect for us anymore. Everything's changed after 9/11, ladies and gentlemen. This also from McClatchy newspaper, so I guess it's somewhat outside the bubble. In a country where the economy is in tatters, electricity outages happen daily. What country would that be? Violence is widespread and seemingly random, and sectarian militias have killed thousands. Iraq's passport offices are doing booming business. Interviews suggest increasing numbers of Iraqis, particularly the remaining middle class and the poor who can scrape together a $28 fee, are hedging their bets by having passports at the ready. Others are obtaining their documents and immediately fleeing the country. But this is the post-war. And we really didn't plan for that. Dateline Fort Eustis, Virginia. Months before the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld forbade military strategists from developing plans for securing post-war Iraq. That, according to the retiring commander of the Army Transportation Corps, in an interview this week with a small newspaper in Virginia. In fact, said Brigadier General Mark Scheid, Rumsfeld said, quote, he would fire the next person who talked about the need for a post-war plan, unquote. We do have a plan, ladies and gentlemen. This from the Washington Post. The new national strategy for combating terrorism, just out or in, depending on which way you look at it. It includes attacking terrorist organizations, controlling weapons of mass destruction, and protecting the homeland. The strategy places, those are good ideas, but here, listen to this. The strategy places new emphasis on the need for training experts in languages and Islamic culture. It's 5 years after 9/11. For enhanced partnerships abroad and with the American Muslim community. It's 5 years after 9/11. And for better information sharing among domestic counterterrorism agencies. It's 5 years after 9/11, ladies and gentlemen. Need I say it one more time? Oh, a little bit more. From the Washington Post on Sunday, the clandestine U.S. commandos, whose job it is to capture or kill Osama bin Laden, have not received a credible lead in more than 2 years. Nothing, no tips from informants, no snippets from electronic intercepts, no points on any satellite image, has led them anywhere near the al-Qaeda leader, according to U.S. and Pakistani officials. The handful of assets we have given us nothing close to real-time intelligence that could lead to his capture, says one terrorism official. Says the trail has gone, quote, stone cold. We'll bring in Steve Austin. In the last 3 months following a request from President Bush to flood the zone, in the last 3 months, ladies and gentlemen, the CIA has sharply increased the number of intelligence officers and assets devoted to the pursuit of bin Laden. The problem, say former and current terrorism, counterterrorism officials, no one is certain where the zone is. Flood the zone, but you figure out where the zone is. Here you have a guy who's gone off the net and is hiding in some of the most formidable terrain in one of the most remote parts of the world, surrounded by people he trusts, says T. McCreary, spokesman for the National Counterterrorism Center. That's an extremely difficult problem. Many factors combined since 9/11 to make the pursuit more difficult. They include the lack of CIA access to people close to al-Qaeda's inner circle, Pakistan's unwillingness to pursue him. Why would that be? The reemergence of the Taliban? Why would that be? The strength of the Iraqi insurgency, which has depleted U.S. resources, and, according to the Washington Post, the U.S. government's own disorganization. It's been so long since there's been anything like a real close call that some operatives have given bin Laden a nickname. Elvis, for all the wishful thinking sightings that have substituted for anything real. Pakistan, ladies and gentlemen, has grown increasingly reluctant to help the U.S. search. The Army lost its best source of intelligence 2 years ago after it began raids inside the tribal areas. Scouts with blood ties to the tribe ceased sharing information for fear of retaliation. For good reason. At least 23 anti-Taliban tribesmen have been assassinated since May of last year. Al-Qaeda footprints were found everywhere, says a source. Pakistan and U.S. counterterrorism and military officials admit Pakistan has now all but stopped looking for bin Laden. The dirty little secret, says one former counterterrorism officer, is they have nothing, no operations, without the PACs. And Don Rumsfeld was unhappy that the CIA, not the Defense Department, had carried out one successful strike in November 2002. Why aren't you giving the intel to us, he demanded, instead of to the CIA? Saddam Hussein regarded al-Qaeda as a threat rather than a possible ally, says the Senate Intelligence Committee's part of its Phase 2 report issued this week. You know all that. Here are some gems from the report, though, because I was sitting on the tarmac waiting for the ground crew in Toronto to decide that the thunderstorm wasn't scary anymore. So I had a chance to read some of this. From the Senate, now remember the Senate is controlled by Republicans, ladies and gentlemen. From the Senate Intelligence Committee's latest report on pre-war intelligence regarding Iraq. Overall, the declassification process on this report was a substantial improvement over past efforts. The committee disagrees with the intelligence community's decision to classify certain proportions of this report. In its decision to keep this information from the public, the intelligence community was unable to demonstrate to the committee that disclosing the information would compromise sensitive sources and methods or otherwise harm national security. The committee concludes that the intelligence community's decision to classify this information is without justification. In October 2002, the Deputy Director of Central Intelligence commented that that British white paper that was depended upon for the statement in the State of the Union address that Iraq had tried to get yellow cake from an African country, quote, stretched a little bit on the points about Iraq seeking uranium from various African locations. Said the deputy director of Central Intelligence 4 months, 3 months before the State of the Union address. We've looked at those reports and we don't think they're very credible. The statement in the original national intelligence estimate, the one right before the war, that Iraq was expanding the infrastructure, research laboratories, production facilities, and procurement networks to produce nuclear weapons, was not supported by the raw intelligence reporting. The committee concluded that the intelligence community's judgments that all key aspects of the offensive biological weapons program are active, and most elements are larger and more advanced than they were before the Gulf War, were not supported by the intelligence reporting. The Iraq Survey Group, did you know this? Recovered evidence that Iraq explicitly turned down an offer to purchase uranium from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Turned it down, ladies and gentlemen. And the CIA review of its pre-war chemical assessments noted the credibility of pre-war sources who reported Iraq was producing or hiding chemical weapons, quote, has been called into question in varying degrees. The review added, quote, this is the CIA's own review of its pre-war intelligence. The review added, quote, intense interest in information on Iraq's WMD capabilities lowered the threshold for reporting such information and increased the volume of reporting from less credible sources, unquote. Have you ever heard, ladies and gentlemen, of a daintier way to phrase that?
Em seus olhos, maior me causa o efeito. De concha no ouvido, barulho de mar, de pouco de onda, de bombo de espuma e sal. Nenhuma taça me mata a sede, mas o sarrabulho me embriaga. Mergulho na onda vaga. Eu caio na rede, não tem quem não caia. Caio na rede, não tem quem não caia. Caio na rede. Às vezes eu penso que sai dos teus olhos. Feixe de raio que controla a onda cerebral do peixe. É, às vezes eu penso que sai dos teus olhos o feixe de raio que controla a onda cerebral do peixe. Nenhuma rede é maior do que o mar, nem quando ultrapassa o tamanho. Ela acerta, nem quando ela erra, nem quando ela envolve todo o planeta. Explode e devolve pro seu olhar o tanto de tudo que o topo te dá. Se a rede é maior do que o meu amor, não tem quem me prove. Se a rede é maior do que o meu amor, não tem quem me prove. Se a rede é maior do que o meu amor, não tem quem me prove. Se a rede é maior do que o meu amor, não tem quem me prove. Sai dos teus olhos o feixe de raio que controla a onda cerebral do peixe. É, às vezes eu penso que sai dos teus olhos o feixe de raio que controla a onda cerebral do peixe. Meu amor, não tem quem me prove. Se a rede é maior do que o meu amor, não tem quem me prove. Se a rede é maior do que o meu amor, não tem quem me prove. Se a rede é maior do que o meu amor, não tem quem me prove. Se a rede é maior do que o meu amor, não tem quem me prove. Se a rede é maior do que o meu amor, não tem quem me prove. Se a rede é maior. Yeah.
This is Le Show from Toronto. I'm sorry, Toronto. It's hard to remember, isn't it? Except when you're in Toronto. Then there are people here to remind you. There's always somebody there to remind you. Ladies and gentlemen, you know that President Bush has been doing a series of speeches this past week on Iraq, on security, on 9/11, the whole thing. The thing. And the speech last Thursday was a corker. In it, he acknowledged for the first time the existence of the black prisons that were first reported by the Washington Post last December to the anger of the administration at the time. Prisons that were reputedly located in Eastern European countries, reportedly Poland and Romania. Shh, I didn't say that. Where high-value detainees, the HVDs, were kept. They're now being moved to Guantanamo and will be given trials in front of military tribunals, assuming that the Congress passes legislation to legalize military tribunals, because the Supreme Court said you can't do it without Congress. The decision to make the black prisons public, they were run by the CIA. Now, reportedly, the CIA has none. The president said that the CIA and those with those detainees used, quote, alternative methods of interrogation, which is almost as delicate as intense interest lowered the bar for reporting. Alternative methods of interrogation, not torture. Why would you say torture? Why do you hate freedom? So now they're being turned over to the military at Gitmo, and the military has just issued a new field manual which prohibits many alternative methods of interrogation. As I say, the president's decision to make the black prison program public came after a series of meetings, contentious meetings, we're told. You know that Secretary of State Rice was in favor of the new policy. And to find out who was against it, we might have to go subterranean.
Next, intimate tales of America's first underground vice president. The action-packed diary of the man who's less than a heartbeat away from history.
Dick Cheney.
Confidential.
When you're making an omelet, you gotta break some eggs. Heck, sometimes you actually have to go ahead and torture or kill the eggs. People say that's hard-nosed. Well, when you're in an existential battle against those who would wish us ill, and against those who don't believe we're even in an existential battle, sometimes even against a constituent chief who's not sure what that means, the soft of nose need not apply. The end of summer means the artificial sunlight ends earlier at the secure undisclosed. Navy believes mimicking the natural rhythm of the seasons is good for our well-being. But you just hate to see that yellowish light give way to the less yellowish light earlier and earlier. Maybe that change was making my proboscis a little bit tougher than usual. Or maybe it was just having to fight an existential battle against a Secretary of State whose idea of toughness is wearing kinky boots. The constituent in chief was planning to unveil a new policy towards the detainment of evildoers. And I was rolling up my sleeves right up to the knuckles to make sure that the new policy was the old policy. A certain Miss Rice was in the way. Tuesday, 2:17 p.m.
As we've argued for months, the intelligence value of what we're getting from those detainees is far overshadowed by the black eye the United States is getting among Europeans, among people in the Middle East, among those whose primary concern is human rights.
Madam Secretary, please wake me when we're getting a black eye among people I should care about.
Mr. Vice President, America is supposed to stand for something.
It does. And the very first thing it stands for is the survival of America. Without that, all these little rights and privileges you care so much about are nothing more than wallpaper in the United Nations men's room.
You know...
Pardon me. And ladies' room. You know, I think I'd like to hear from the Attorney General.
You'd like to hear from him because he agrees with you.
That doesn't make him a bad person. Go ahead, Al.
Thanks. Folks, the fact that the Justice Department has generated
memos defending alternative methods of interrogation as legal, memos that have subsequently been withdrawn, should tell you one thing. We have what it takes to do it again. If we need it to be legal, it can be legal.
See, that's the kind of can-do attitude I wanted a foxhole with me, where I'd have a different set of priorities such that I might actually be in a foxhole.
I think I'll be in a foxhole before you will, Dick.
Only if they open a Prada in one.
Folks.
Yes, Carl.
We gotta have a decision here. The decider has to make a speech on Thursday, and if we don't make a decision, the decider can't announce it.
Mm.
Me, I'm, of course, just domestic policy advisor, but it looks like maybe, and you know how it pains me to say this, that maybe you have to lean in the Secretary of State's direction on this one. I mean, we can still be good and mean to the detainees in Gitmo, right?
Not if the people at Gitmo are bound by the new Army Field Manual.
Well, they are in the Army, so that might be a tough nut to avoid.
Well, still...
folks, I hate to disturb our civilized little gathering here, but this broken bottle symbolizes what you're about to do to a fine, productive, and most important, really scary program.
I'm sorry. We're about to break its neck off?
Miss Rice, and by the way, my regards to your significant other as soon as you happen to find one. But those Europeans you care so much about, or should I say the new Europeans who've actually helped us with the black prison program, they're going to feel a little betrayed if the constituent-in-chief comes out and says the program they've denied is happening on their soil is, in fact, happening on their soil. I don't think that's the way we treat our friends.
Well, if you ask the Shiites who rebelled in Iraq back in 1992 when we suggested we'd help them, I think it is.
Appreciate the history lesson, but the next time we go to the new democracies of Eastern Europe and ask them to let us have a black prison on their soil in return for a little unaudited line of foreign aid funds, I'm guessing their price is going to be significantly higher.
Well, chance we've got to take. Our polling says Americans don't like torture anymore.
Well, of course, Carl, it's not torture under our definition, although we'd be happy to write the memos any old which way. I think I have to side with Secretary Rice just for the sake of not getting another lecture from the Supreme Court a year from now.
All right, then. I'm guessing we're voting.
Yes, Mr. Vice President, I guess we are. Nothing like bringing democracy to the White House.
Remind me not to be around when Condi Rice starts packing on the pounds. Sarcasm doesn't look so hot coming out of a portly woman's mouth. The day later, I'm wrapping up the black prison account back in the secure undisclosed with the ambassador from the United Kingdom. Wednesday, 4:17 p.m.
Rather early for the sun to be going down, isn't it? Feels like Christmas in Dublin.
Navy guys say the computer crashed. The clocks haven't been reset. Yes. So look, Ambassador, you know we value the relationship with Britain almost as much as we value our relationship with ourselves.
Well, it's a relationship, obviously, that our Prime Minister cares about enough to have virtually sacrificed his legacy for. I'm sure you know that.
Hey, none of us are in this for the glory. But I hear that our friend Mr. Blair may be in line for some prime corporate directorship soon after he departs, number 10, so I'm not crying for him, Argentina. But now look, There's some loose ends to wrap up here on the black prison matter.
Well, I appreciate there might be, but that's hardly a matter for Her Majesty's government to...
We flew some of those high-value detainees through your airports, my friend, so this is not really a propitious time for you to be Her Majesty-ing me.
Well, I believe we demonstrated absolutely world-class deniability on this flight.
So we're looking for you to let our Eastern European friends know that as of about noon tomorrow Eastern time, the Black Prison Project is being publicly acknowledged and disbanded. The detainees being transferred to Gitmo and prepared for military tribunals if and when Congress can find the cojones to legalize them.
And you're going through us because...
Strange that I have to explain myself to a junior member of the partnership. I don't remember reading that in the manual.
Seriously, Mr. Vice President, why should Britain have to shoulder the burden of enduring the anger and the outrage of allies who are about to be profoundly embarrassed and
front of their domestic publics.
That's a good reason right there. I think our plate is about full up with anger and outrage at the moment. But little reality check for you, Mr. Ambassador. Your country fancies itself as the leader of Europe. These disappointed little principalities are in Europe. So lead them. Besides, I don't think you're getting out of here without acceding to my little proposition.
I assure you, you're not threatening me with physical violence.
Oh, no, sir, of course not. I'm just suggesting that's one bottle of Meursault you won't be sampling tonight. Too bad. Parker gave it a 97.
Yes. Well, Mr. Vice President, of course, this can't become public knowledge at a time when our government are facing intense criticism for being your government's poodle.
Of course not.
And by that I mean that this can't actually become public at any time before Mr. Blair leaves office.
Of course not. Just suggest to our European friends that silence right about now will buy them another nice line of unaudited funding in the next fiscal year.
Understood.
Fine. Wish I could offer you some wine, but...
No, that's all right, Mr. Vice President. I should just like to be escorted back up outside before virtual darkness falls.
I think that can be arranged. Omelets are funny things. Sometimes you break the eggs. Sometimes the eggs break you. End of partial diary for the start of September 2006. Sincerely yours, Dick Cheney. Confidential.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, just time for a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. The apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
In an exclusive interview with CBS News, one of those exclusive interviews that was duplicated all over the dial, Richard Armitage, once the number two diplomat at the State Department, says, "Oh, I feel terrible. Every day I think I let down the president. I let down the Secretary of State. I let down my department, my family. I also let down Mr. and Mrs. Wilson." It's because he was the source of the original source of the information that Valerie Plame was a CIA operative. When asked if he feels he owes the Wilsons an apology, he says, quote, "I think I've just done it." Baseball apologies, because I love saying this guy's name. Twins commentator Bert Blyleven has been suspended for two telecasts for accidentally using two profanities on the air during a pregame segment. Blyleven thought Sunday's pregame show was being taped, so when he flubbed part of a segment, he used a profane word a couple of times. He quickly realized he was actually on live television. Blyleven apologized repeatedly during the Twins-Yankees game. "I want to apologize for what was said at the open," Blyleven told viewers. "I thought it was a tape, and I apologize to the viewers for my language. It makes me feel bad. I'm sorry." Thomas Bjorn has been fined by the European Golf Tour for his unacceptable criticism of the Ryder Cup captain. Bjorn issued an apology. He said, "I'm an impassionate guy who believes that the Ryder Cup is one of the world's greatest sporting events." And that was his first mistake. And the University of South Carolina tailback Corey Boyd apologized for making a reference to crack cocaine during ESPN's telecast of Thursday's game at Mississippi State. Sports apologies, ladies and gentlemen. Always good. The apology of the week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Oh, a couple more. Mel Gibson has apologized to the three police officers he insulted when arrested for drunk driving. And Hewlett-Packard's chairwoman, Patricia Dunn, says she's going to write notes of apology to nine reporters whose records were obtained through subterfuge by company-paid investigators. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz shortwave. Around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network. Did I say that? I'm losing track now. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want at harryshearer.com, kcrw.com. Available at Channel 136 at Sirius Satellite Radio on Mighty 104 in Berlin as a free download from www.audible.com/LeShow and as a free podcast from kcrw.com. And it would be just like Ameritrade being owned by Americans if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty. Thank you very much. And congratulations to News Corporation Chairman and Chief Executive Rupert Murdoch, who's gotten a $21 million bonus for the fiscal year ended June 30th, up from $18.9 million last year. Go, Roop! Roop, can I have some? The email address for this program is LeMail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, and Chicago desks. Le Show playlists available at harryshearer.com. Le Show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW, Santa Monica. I've been asked this over and over again, so let me reiterate. Santa Monica? Yes. It's a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.